Welcome to the Fanboy Factor Podcast. I am your friendly neighborhood J-Man. With me is our resident comic book historian, Brian Isaacs. Brian, how's it going?
Doing good, sir. How are you?
Not too bad. Brian, we got a special guest with us today.
Yes, we do.
We've got the editor-in-chief of Dark Horse Comics, Scott Alley. Scott, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you guys?
Doing good. Welcome
aboard.
Doing good.
So, Scott, what's going on? What's new?
Lots of new. We're wrapping up the 20th anniversary year for Hellboy, which has been one of the biggest things for me this year. In March, we marked Hellboy's 20th anniversary, and we've had a lot of special stuff going on all year, and we're wrapping it up in December with Hellboy and the BPRD, which tells the story of Hellboy's first mission with the Bureau, and it's written by Mignola and John Arcudi and drawn by Alex Malev.
That's awesome.
I am a huge Hellboy and BPRD fan. I've been following it for, since it first started, and I still remember running into Mike over at this con over in New York City, and this is right after they just started, they were in the process of doing posts on the Hellboy film, and he was like giddy as a schoolgirl. He was so excited.
Yeah. The movie took a long time coming, but it was a dream come true.
Yeah, can you get into more detail about the new series?
Yeah, in 1944, Hellboy was basically discovered on Earth and adopted by Trevor Brueggemann, who founded the Bureau for Paranormal Research and Defense, sort of as a way to give Hellboy a home, like an official place to take care of him, observe him, and try to raise him. And Hellboy grew up very quickly. He showed up as a baby in 44, but by 1952, he was full grown, and he was getting restless, and so Broom decided to send him on a mission. At that time, the BPRD was mostly composed of World War II vets, and not necessarily people with, like, a background in occultism, besides Broom and a couple of other agents, but a lot of them were just, you know, retired World War II vets who needed a job, needed something to do. And so there was this series of murders in a small South American town that appeared to have something to do with a monster, possibly some, you know, vampire-type monster. So the BPRD was going to investigate, and Broom, realizing that Hellboy was growing restless, stuck on the base, decided to send him. And everybody was a little nervous about it, and it didn't go well for him. And that's where the story kicks off. That's the first issue.
That's cool.
Now, is obviously, you know, Professor Broom and Hellboy are in it. Are any of the characters from, like, BPRD, was it 1946, going to be in there?
Yeah, there's a couple characters from 46, 47, and 48 who are sticking around. Archie is this guy who you see a couple of times throughout, I think mostly 47 and 48, who's really the guy who befriends Hellboy and is the kindest to him on the base. But we've never seen Archie really in action before. We've mostly seen him around the base. And here, he's one of the main guys taking Hellboy down to South America. Another character named Stegner was one of the main guys sent to Europe in 1947 to investigate the vampire scenario there. And Stegner was a main character in 47 and 48. And now he's with Hellboy on this mission. And another character who kind of rears his ugly head is Malcolm Frost. Malcolm Frost was the guy who was there with Broom at those ruins, the church ruins in England when Hellboy first appeared.
Right.
And Frost was the guy who took one look at Hellboy and was like, we gotta kill it. And Broom disagreed, and Frost continued to kind of hassle Broom for years about this demon that he was, you know, trying to raise as a child. And so Frost pops up in a small but significant way in this series.
Cool.
Hey, Scott, is this going to be a ongoing series or is it a miniseries?
It's a miniseries, but it's like the classic Hellboy model where we're going to do... The idea is to do like 5 or so issues a year. So we're doing this first one, which is a single 5-issue story, all set in 1952, this one mission. And then the plan is, starting middle of next year, we'll release books to kind of take this story forward. And the idea isn't a fully ongoing series, you know, a fully monthly series, but we're going to return to this storyline, you know, frequently over the next few years. The way Mike and I look at it, when we first came up with the idea to do this book, I was like, why didn't we think of this sooner? You know, we launched the BPRG title in, I think, 2001 for the first time, right after Hellboy had quit the BPRD. But actually doing stories of Hellboy with the Bureau, especially in the earlier days, just seemed like a great idea that had been sitting right in front of us all these years. So now, you know, if you follow the current BPRD series, the world is rapidly ending. Hellboy's dead. He's in hell, literally in hell in his own book, while the BPRD guys deal with these Lovecraftian monsters that are wiping out the human race. So that book is sort of going off in its own direction. But going back to 1952 allows us to do stories set in, you know, a more relatable real world for as long as we want. Because basically we could keep doing this series easily up through 1993 when the original Hellboy series kicked off.
Yeah.
Oh. Now, I know in some of the books, they do have a lot of, there was a lot of flashback stories from previous adventures. I mean, I'm assuming that we might, like, see hinting at some of those, or...
There'll be some overlap with that stuff, because, yeah, the first Hellboy comic was, actually came out in, 94. The comic came out in 94, and since then, we've mostly moved forward through time, but every once in a while, Mike does a Hellboy story set before that. Because in 94, Hellboy met Rasputin and started to, like, get a glimmer of where he came from.
Right.
But whenever Mike wanted to do a story that was sort of the naive Hellboy before he was tapping into any of that knowledge, he'd have to set it prior to 94. And so those stories all might take place in, you know, like The Corpse, I think, takes place in 1961. That's one of our favorite stories. And other stuff, we've done stories set throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And so these new Hellboy and the BPRD comics, as we plot these, as we move forward, we'll be keeping an eye on where we know Hellboy was in any given year, what he was doing at any given time. And, you know, work, you know, in tandem with all that.
Scott, are you going to do any kind of writing on the new series?
Not on this one. I don't foresee myself doing any of the Hellboy the BPRD stuff. Abe is monthly, and I'm writing Abe Sapien monthly. And between the editor-in-chief duties and that, that is all I can handle.
Yeah.
But Mike and I have talked about when Abe wraps up, because we got an end of date on Abe. When that wraps up, there's some other stuff I'd like to do in the universe.
Yeah, and Abe's been one of just, besides Hellboy, wow, what an evolution on that character. Just from a blank slate to finding out back in, you know, how old he actually is, to this new evolution in him is just... It's been one hell of a ride, I gotta tell you. It's, I mean, other than Hellboy's, like, you know, Abe is... been one of my favorite characters, and you know, I was almost gonna freak out if you guys killed him off, because I was just like, I understand, you know, the point of view, you know, I really admire, you know, to take, you know, actually kill off a character. Like, I wasn't happy about killing off Roger, but you know, I can accept it because you know, it's, you guys don't really have that revolving door of death like some of the big two usually do. So it is.
Right.
Yeah, so I was kind of hoping, I was just like, oh god, don't kill him off, but, I mean...
Abe's got an incredible evolution, and there's more to be seen yet, you know, I mean, so Abe was revealed in, like, a long time ago. Mike did a comic called Play the Frogs, BKB Play the Frogs, that revealed Abe's origins as a Civil War era scientist, and since then, Abe's kind of slowly pieced things together about himself, but one of the big differences between Abe and Hellboy is that Abe always wanted to know the truth. But more recently, when people started suggesting that he had something to do with these Lovecraftian monsters that are trying to wipe out mankind, since then, Abe's been kind of running from the truth. He says he's trying to find out the truth about himself, but the fact is he's kind of turning a blind eye to it. But actually, before I before I got on the phone with you guys, I was working on the script for Abe 24, which is the point at which he really throws himself seriously into the search for truth about himself, and he'll start putting some of the pieces together. So the whole cycle of this Abe monthly series that me and Mike are doing is Abe finally finding out the whole picture about who and what he really is.
Wow. It just, you know, one of the things I have noticed is just, especially the way he's just avoiding his, you know, his family, the BPRD. Is there a chance of him actually going back and teaming up with them again, or it's kind of wait and see?
Yeah. The opening scene in this issue is a flashback to 1992, because I wanted to kind of contrast the lonely path that he's on now with the fact that he used to pal around with Broom and with Hellboy and Liz and Kate. And I wanted to kind of have that moment of showing that friendship in contrast to the fact that now he's, you know, he's in pretty rough shape and he's chosen to be solo at a really vulnerable and kind of terrible time. But yeah, obviously the door is open if he wants to go back to the BPRD for as long as, you know, the BPRD itself is still there.
Very ominous there.
Hey, can we just switch gears a little bit and talk about your duties as editor-in-chief?
Yeah, sure.
What's that like? How do you go from writing Abe to being editor-in-chief? I mean, how does that balance for you?
The balance is tough, not just between Abe and editor-in-chief. It's really editor-in-chief and everything else. You know, I've been an editor at Dark Horse for 20 years, and over that time, I've just, you know, gradually kind of steadily gotten more and more involved in, like, the upper management end of things.
Yeah.
And it was all a sort of smooth, gradual progression until the point where I became editor-in-chief, where I really thought, and I think Mike Richardson thought too, that, like, oh, this is just going to be more of the same. But it did kind of mark a big change. Getting the title did sort of give me more, responsibility to the other editors, to the staff, to kind of, you know, work for them and advocate for them. And so the part of the job that I love the most is making the books, and whether that's writing a or editing any of this other stuff, you know, that's one part of the job. And writing Abe doesn't feel to me that dissimilar from what I do on any of my other books.
Yeah.
What feels really dissimilar is this management role, where my kind of, for 20 years as an editor, I've had, you know, personnel obligations. I've got to be responsible for the freelancers that I work with.
Yeah.
But the responsibilities that you have to the in-house staff when you're, you know, a VP level guy working with, you know, the junior editors and stuff, the responsibility that you have to them is much different than what you have to the freelancers who aren't there every day, who aren't, you know, full-time employees.
And so,
making books one way or another, that's all one thing, and that feels very natural and very, you know, easy and kind of what I'm all about. And the other stuff is, you know, there's more to grow and learn there still.
And you started, you took over in 2012, right? Is that in chief?
I think so, yeah. Again, it was funny because when I got the promotion, I didn't think of it as much of a change. I thought it was just kind of making official responsibilities that I already had. But that was naive of me thinking that. But yeah, you're right. It was 2012. And at the time, it felt like just a change of title and nothing more. But it was actually... You
know, it was a lot more.
I got to ask, you know, it's just 20 years of Hellboy is just... Wow. Did you ever, in your wildest dreams, think that this character would ever make it this, you know, this level of popularity, just make it this far?
Well, you know, before the movies, it was one of Dark Horse's most popular books. Like, without the movies, it was already Dark Horse's, you know, one of Dark Horse's most popular books and most consistent creator-owned books, you know, coming out most often, most reliably. I never thought necessarily about it being around 20 years, but I also never imagined it ending, you know? I mean, comics, the comics that we all grew up on went on and on and on forever and ever. So I guess I never thought about how or why Hellboy would end. I knew that Mike had a very big story to tell, and that story has just kind of grown organically over time. So now we do have a real clear idea of how it ends, and we haven't mapped it out exactly on the calendar, but we kind of know when it ends.
Really?
And then after that, there's still stuff. Yeah, when we get past that point where the current modern-day story has to end, there's still room to do more stories set in the past. Like I said, we can do Elbow in the B-Period, we can do that title all the way up through, you know, 1993, 94, pretty easily. And you know, there's Lobster Johnson to tell, there's Witchfinder to tell, there's other stuff even further back in history that we've talked about delving into more deeply. Some of it way prehistory. But yeah, I certainly never thought in 1994, 1998, oh, it's only going to go another 5 years, it's only going to go another 12 years. Now that we're this far into it, it is really cool to be able to see the shape of the whole thing and to know where it's going and to know where it, you know, where it has to end.
Wow.
It has to end.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the cool things about working on Hellboy is I feel like Mike has really done something that nobody else had ever done. I mean, we're telling this now quite enormous story through comics, and every single step of the way, it's been Mike guiding it. It's been the creator guiding it. And there's lots of books you can say that about, but specifically what we've done, bringing in a lot of other artists and writers, doing this sort of expansive thing, making room for other voices while still being guided by Mike. I don't think there's anything else quite like it. And I think, you know, 20 years from now, when it's all totally in the past and you can buy it all in, like, you know, a particular library sort of format and have all the books, I like to imagine some kid discovering the whole thing as a whole, the way that, you know, obviously one of us can pick up Lord of the Rings and the whole thing's right there in front of you, you read the whole thing. Yeah. I like to think that Hellboy will ultimately have as unified a vision and as complete a story as that sort of thing, but in a way that has never been done before in any medium.
One of my favorite things about Hellboy is just the amount of research that goes into some of these stories. It's just amazing, the, you know, the researching of different, the blending of different mythologies and, you know, different urban, you know, legends and things like that. It's just, and then you guys put your own particular spin on that. It's pure amazing writing. It just really is.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, part of it comes from just how deep a reader Mike is. You know, Mike kind of jokes about how people imagine him as this researcher going through these, you know, dusty old libraries to find these books, but really it's mostly just stuff that he's found at Powell's or in dusty old bookstores in Berkeley, in you know, some sort of crappy paperback edition. I mean, he's got really nice books, but he's also just been reading this subject matter since he was a kid, and then you sort of process it in a very natural way into the work. That's one of the things that he and I bonded on from the beginning when I was, you know, like a young, just starting at Dark Horse. We'd read enough of the same stuff that we kind of got each other right off the bat.
How has, and maybe, I don't want to ask this, do you or Mike feel that the movies have affected where Hellboy is going or has gone?
Well, I mean, the movies made it possible, or maybe the movies just made it possible for us to imagine expanding it into what it's become. You know, I mean, like, for a long time, Mike just did as many comics as he could, and that was pretty much the Hellboy universe.
Yeah.
The movies gave us so much exposure at a level that you could never get any other way than having a big-budget movie come out. It gave us, or, you know, a TV show, but it gave us such huge exposure that we were like, yeah, we can do a B3D comic, we can do an H16 comic. And it was the, you know, it was the movies that helped make sure that people know what Hellboy is and what this stuff is. So they, you know, they definitely opened the door by giving us access to a much bigger readership. But, you know, the movies don't necessarily sell the comics. You gotta rely on the comics to do their own work. So, definitely opened the door.
I think one of my things is I think that having Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man has affected Marvel Comics and how they portray Iron Man in their comics. It, to me, it's a little bit of a curse because now they got this charismatic guy, and when newcomers come in, they kind of, and I definitely think this happened right after the first Iron Man hit. They want Robert Downey Jr. So I guess that's what I was sort of driving at, is if any of having Ron Perlman, not that he's this, he's a big guy, but if any of that affected storylines or made you think differently about where Hellboy is or where any of the characters are and where they're going.
Not exactly. I mean, there were ways in which that happened. I mean, one thing is that one of the great things is that both Ron Perlman and Guillermo were such big fans of the comics. I think, anyway. I mean, I know Guillermo was, and I think Ron was. That they really modeled what they did after what Mike did.
Yeah.
Now that's less true, obviously. They're faking. Like the way we view it, Mike and John and everybody. The Abe and the Liz in the movie are completely different characters. They're not, you know, our characters at all.
Right.
And so any time that anything from the movie kind of makes its way toward us, we get pushed back against it. Like, there's been things where, you know, not John, but like another writer would talk about how Abe is psychic. It's like, oh, he's never read the comic. You saw the movie because it's most definitely not psychic in the comics, you know, and Liz doesn't have black hair. I mean, that might be people looking at Mike's artwork wrong, but you know, Liz has red hair in the comics. Guillermo didn't want her to have red hair in the movie for really good movie reasons, but in the comics she's got red hair. So sometimes you see artists, especially new artists or like people who are just coming on to do covers, where they're a little bit too influenced by the film, and we got to push back against that.
That's kind of cool.
You know, the fact of the movie's existence influenced things in various ways. I mean, one big thing was that like Mike was supposed to be doing the comic The Island right before the movie. And I think the movie was messing with his head because he was working with Guillermo on the screenplay. He was working with Guillermo on conceiving the movie. And he kind of had, and we've documented all this in like the collections, but he had a couple of false starts on the book The Island.
Yeah.
And in a way, there's some ways in which in some of Mike's books, and I think he said this, you know, more than once, that he sort of accelerated some stuff that he was doing because he didn't want the movies to tell kind of the punchline or didn't want the movies to get to the big stuff before the comics got there.
Right.
So if you look at The Island is a place, the book The Island, which is collected in Strange Places, Mike kind of dove really deeply into some of the lore because he wanted to make sure to get it out there before the movie started overshadowing things. But those are the ways in which the movie affected the comic, you know, like and the thing is Mike's involvement, something that just popped into my head, Mike's involvement in the movie just blurs the lines a lot, you know. There's a lot of stuff, like Hellboy's obsessed with cats, or Hellboy's got a lot of pet cats. In the film. Not too long after the first film, I guess, we did Darkness Calls, and there's a business of cats in that. They're not his pets, but it's like, well, cats are classic supernatural, kind of tropes, and so Guillermo used them one way in the film, and Mike used them in a real different way in the comic. But when we put a cat on the cover of Darkness Calls #1, I think people thought that was a reference to the movie, but it was just, it was like, well, but they're not his buddies. They're like kind of, you know, his clues, sort of.
So you guys really pushed back on that movie stuff, which is cool.
Yeah, in some ways, I mean, it's great. We're grateful for the movies. The movies, you know, really changed the world for us in terms of the books in a lot of ways. But, you know, the movies are Guillermo's characters and the comics are Mike's characters. And there's got to be some separation. And again, like, if an artist draws Hellboy's hand with runes carved into it, obviously you better get him to fix it because that's totally a movie thing. Mike has cracks in the hands, not runes, you know, but...
Makes sense.
Those characters.
Yeah, I guess I just kind of, you know, I have one last simple question. I mean, like you said, the 20th anniversary. I mean, what else, what do you guys have planned for the rest of the year for to celebrate?
Well, you know, I mean, we're at the tail end of the year, so the Hellboy and the BPRD being the big end of year launch really feels like we're going out with a bang. It's going to be the best selling comic in the line besides the stuff that Mike does all by himself. So that, you know, that feels good. And then next year is going to be another good year for Hellboy. Me and the publicist were looking at the schedule and it's like, wow, in the months, I think it's like from March until October next year, we have like a significant launch or significant single issue of a long running thing every single month, and it's going to be another year that makes it really easy for Dark Horse to put a lot of energy and a lot of focus behind Hellboy. You know, I love this little universe that we've created, and I love that we continue to have new things to announce. Like, there's a couple things coming up that we're going to get to announce that are really cool, and I'm not going to
announce them
right now, but you know, it's like the ideas keep popping up, like new things keep popping up, and one of the things about the way that Mike plots stories, and John and me as well, hopefully, as we sort of answer questions and close off pathways in the story, we always try to make sure that there are multiple sort of possibilities thrown in. What I mean is like little buds that pop up in the story, like maybe this will be a thing, maybe this character that we introduce will be a bigger thing over time. And sometimes they do become that, and sometimes they don't. One of the best ones, one of the weirdest ones for us, was this character Vivara, who first appeared in BPRD 1946. This little girl who was the head of the Russian occult services department. This little girl in a white dress who drinks vodka and turns out to actually be a demon in disguise as a small child. Mike dreamed up Vivara for that. Josh Dysart helped to create her for that series. And we loved her and we thought she was cool, but she just continues to grow in importance. She shows up in the first issue of Hellboy in the BPRD, and she's in the current day BPRD stories in a somewhat significant role. And that was a character that when introduced, we didn't know that she'd really go anywhere, but the artists loved to draw her. John loved to write her. And so she just continued to take on more and more significance. Sometimes that doesn't happen. You know, sometimes a character gets introduced, you think there's a lot of potential there, but nothing really clicks, and so they don't wind up being all that important. But Vivara was a great one, and now it feels like you could do anything with her.
Very cool.
Very cool. Brian, do you have anything else you want to ask Scott?
Not that I want to ask, but just, you know, thank you for, like, 20 years of Hellboy, man. It's been awesome. It's been a great run.
Thanks.
And looking forward to hopefully another 20 years. Right. Can't tell by the way you were saying
it. Sounds like it's...
We'll be doing something for a good long time. But yeah, the current day storyline, Mike has been saying for a couple years ago, he started saying that we're breaking things that can't be fixed. And that's really true. We don't have a reset button where you just say, oh, Galactus knocked over New York City, but we need a book to come out next week so everything's going to be better. Like, as these Lovecraft monsters and all this other crap is wiping out North America and everywhere else, we are breaking things that can't be fixed, and we've killed off some pretty important characters, and, you know, you kind of ain't seen nothing yet.
Wow.
Looking forward to it.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us, Scott.
All right, good talking to you guys.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Have a good night.
Good night. Thanks.
We'll be right back.
Okay, that was Scott Alley from Dark Horse Comics, editor-in-chief, talking about Hellboy and new Hellboy series coming out.
Very cool.
Brian, what do you got going on? It's been a couple weeks. We had some interviews going on, so we really haven't talked fanboy stuff lately.
Nah, we've been busy with a couple people. It's really been, you know, some great shows, but we haven't said squat about anything lately.
Yeah, well, I think the biggest thing for you and me is the passing of Glenn Larson.
Yeah.
Creator of Knight Rider, well, created a lot of stuff, but I think for you and I, Knight Rider and Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's did a lot of the 80s and 70s shows. As campy as they are, looking back now, I mean, it's stuff we grew up with.
Yep.
I mean, it's, you know, the original Battlestar Galactica was just, you know, pretty amazing for its time, and yep. You know, Knight Rider, and there's still a resurgence of Knight Rider stuff, and it's just, it's a huge loss, it really is.
You know, it's funny, every couple of years, something comes up about Knight Rider, whether a reboot or some sort of continuation of it. To me, a lot of these properties that we grew up with, they're just not, they don't translate well when they get rebooted.
No.
I feel that about Knight Rider.
No, I fully agree with you. It's just the car that really doesn't have any, like, in, especially today's audience.
Yeah.
You know, the
cars do all that shit now anyway.
Yeah, it's just like, and without a weapon system, it's, you know, it's not like, you know, it's the reimagining of Battlestar Galactica. I mean, totally, they pretty much just kept the names.
Yeah.
And just started everything from scratch.
Yeah.
You know, just threw out the entire playbook, and, you know, it was a complete reimagining. While the last couple, like, you know, times they've retried to do Knight Rider, they still tried to hold on to the past.
Yeah, it doesn't translate for some reason. Maybe because we're all jaded, or the other direction they go is campy.
Yeah.
When we look back on it now, Knight Rider, it feels campy, but when we were watching it back then, it was not campy. It was a good show.
It was an awesome show back then. It was just like, you know, I think the only function we don't have in cars right now, and which would be really nice, is a car that drives itself so we can take a nap.
There's two things about Battlestar Galactica and Knight Rider that I remember. Two separate things. Knight Rider, one of my favorite things is car. I remember after that came on, like the first couple episodes, I don't know if it was the first one was a two-parter, but Carr was in a couple episodes. I drew a huge picture on the back of a poster board of Carr. Awesome.
and
from Battlestar Galactica, when they came to Earth and they had those badass motorcycles.
Yeah, but that was Galactica 80. That was a little bit different.
But those are my high, you know, those are the things I remember the most.
It's just the Cylon. It was the Cylon, you know, how bad they moved and stuff. Yeah. It was just, but it was such, you know, it was pretty much ahead of its time. They were our shows. I mean, like,
yeah.
You know, we grew up with Larson, you know, so, yeah. I remember transitioning into Magnum PI as I got a little older. Quincy obviously before my time.
Way before my time.
Yeah, I mean, I caught it in reruns, and it was that show was pretty much ahead of its time too. I mean, it was today's Quincy is CSI.
Yeah,
and it's pretty much what it is.
Who was that? Jack Klugman.
Klugman, yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was Fall Guy, which Lord knows how that long that stayed on the air.
That was on for a long time too.
It was a bounty hunter he was a stuntman in his off time. It was
right.
A bounty hunter and
the majors.
God, that was awful. It was just. For me, it's just like after coming down, you know, you have Lee Majors on the pedestal for a $6 million man.
Yeah.
To go to that was just like, oh, God, this is so bad.
5 years it was on, dude, from November 81 to May 86. But it did have Heather Thomas in it.
Oh, God. And then some of his lesser-known ones, BJ and the Bear. God, that definitely came out of, like, that was inspired by Smokey and the Bandit.
Right.
You know, it's pretty much Greg Egavin again driving around with a monkey, and then all of a sudden, yeah, every once in a while he stops by this brothel with all these good girls who were prostitutes. Nobody had daddy issues back then, I guess, for a horse.
Oh my god, that's funny.
And then, yeah, Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys.
Hardy Boys.
Yeah, it's Parker Stevenson and one of the Cassidy brothers.
You know, I thought, well, I'll have to check, but I thought he had some sort of involvement in Love Boat and Fantasy Island. Maybe he was a writer or something.
Maybe.
Could have sworn he had some involvement in both those shows, but I'm probably wrong.
Yeah, he...
Knight Rider, man.
Oh, Knight Rider, it's just...
And then, speaking of today, Diamond Toys has, Diamond Select puts out the kit and car, cars.
Yeah, he also did, here's another one from our era, Buck Rogers.
That was him?
That was him.
No way! Twinkie!
Fuck you, Buck.
Yeah, that was, Erin Gray was on that show.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, she was fun to party with. A couple of years at a con, went out, drinking with her, because they knew the guy who was running the con.
Did you really?
Yeah, she was nice.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm just making fun, you know.
You shithead. So good.
Yeah, it was funny, because one of the guys who was with us was totally hitting on her and stuff, and was just like, I gotta go back to bed. But, real nice. But
Buck Rogers, huh? 79 to 81.
Yeah, it's just
wow. He was really involved in a lot.
Yeah, he really was. It's a shame.
Yeah,
it's a loss. He's had hits and misses depending on who you talk to. But
yeah,
he created a lot of pop culture icons. He really
did.
And his loss will definitely be missed. So now that we've got everybody down.
Yeah. Well, since we got everybody down, let's talk about one of our favorite topics.
Yes.
Let's talk about Multiversity.
Now, we're going to go on the record and say neither one of us read this. And
Pax Americana.
We did not read it, and that was due to choice. What we are commenting on is how everybody is just overanalyzing this piece of crap.
The phenomenon.
Yeah.
I did.
It's, oh my god. So, pretty much, from what I was able to figure out, this is, he's, first off, it's just like, he's ripping off Alan Moore's Watchmen. And for those who don't know, Alan Moore, the Watchmen were supposed to be based on the Charlatan characters originally.
Right.
Like, Night Owl was supposed to originally be Blue Beetle. Dr. Manhattan was supposed to be Captain Atom, et cetera, et cetera.
And DC did not, they're okay for that. They were against that, weren't they?
They were against it because the timing of it, they just bought the Charlatan rights. Mm-hmm. If it would have went earlier, they would have been okay with it.
Okay.
But they just bought the Charlatan rights, and they incorporated them into the main DC universe.
Right.
So if the entire crisis didn't happen, we probably would have seen Watchmen with the actual Charlatan characters.
Okay.
So, it still probably would have been fantastic with the Charlatan characters, but, whatever.
Yeah.
But Pax Americana was just like, once again, Morrison trying to rip off more.
Well, this is my extent of Pax Americana and Multiversity in general. I picked up the first couple issues, and you and I, we've talked about this several times on the show and, amongst ourselves. To me, one of the biggest problems is it's too self-referential.
Yep.
It's too winking at the reader. It's too breaking down the fourth wall. It's too all that crap. So when I was at my comic shop, it was there, and, the last issue that I picked up, I forget, it was the one that was supposed to be a tabloid, whatever. Okay, which one I'm
looking at. I know what you're talking about, yeah.
And when I say that I read the first page and looked at the pictures of the rest of it, that's exactly what I did. So at that point, I think I swore, it was when I officially swore it off. So I go into my comic shop, and it's there, and already I'm backing off my swear. I pick it up, and one of the things that bugs me the most, and I don't know why it bugs me, is the characters in all these books are reading or looking at the comics from other universes, and it just, I don't know. It just bugs me. So, and at that point, I remembered my vow, and I put it down.
It's, Morrison is trying so hard to, a lot of people are saying he's expanding the medium. I'm just like, just tell a fucking story with pictures.
How is he, now I'm not being a dick here, but how is he expanding,
what he did with this one is he wrote, the entire story is told backwards.
Okay.
And not just backwards, but in different, I don't fully understand it. The problem is I didn't read it. I'm only hearing secondhand.
Understood.
Yeah, but it's just like, it's written backwards, and it's everything in reverse, and it's just like, and people are saying it's just like, expand, you know, it's just like totally reinventing the media as a medium, and I'm like, I dealt with shit like this in film school. People experimenting on film, and they call it genius, and I just call it a waste of celluloid.
Are they saying it's avant-garde?
Yeah, pretty much. Without using that term, yeah.
I know. I love that word. And then the artist on it, Frank Quietly, who, you know, to me, I mentioned earlier to you, he's like Alex Ross in the sense that his work, to me, works on certain things, but not everything.
See, for me, it doesn't work, period, because it's just all his... It's everybody looks like they're inflated.
Yeah.
Like they're a little pudgy in their faces. Yeah. It's almost you can count the zits on their skin. It's just, I don't find his art that impressive.
Say it's gritty, because it's not gritty. It's...
It's cartoonish in almost in a weird
way. In a grotesque
way.
Sort of way.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, so that being said... He pointed out that fully appreciate the whole thing along with Pax Americana, you gotta read it a couple times. Well, there are very few books that I have read a couple times. I mean novels, and there are very few comic books that there are maybe 10 that I go back. And I read every once in a while. But my point is, you should see my stack of comics that I'm not reading. I'm not going back, and I'm not analyzing this thing to see what I missed.
Yeah.
Now, if that is what the intent is, and I know that there are people out there that do that and like the layer upon layer of whatever, then I don't know.
But,
I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Again, let's go back to Watchmen. This is exactly what Watchmen did. You read Watchmen, you can take away a different thing from it. It's layers upon layers, Watchmen. And this is fucking Morrison ripping off Moore. I'm sorry. That's just what it is.
I wonder if, has anybody, well, not that he gives interviews, but have reached out to Moore about any of this?
I would love to hear Moore's. Moore is not a fan of Morrison. I think he's actually called him like his, you know, mini-me or something like that.
Did he really? He's actually said something to that?
Something like that. It's just, and of course all the Morrison fans attack Moore, and I'm like, okay, you guys realize who's a better writer here?
But he is a little kooky these days.
Yeah, but
Al Moore, he's a little kooky.
He is a little kooky, but he's not on a drug trip like Morrison is.
Yeah, I just... You said it earlier, and I'm curious what it means, not per se to you, but how he's changing the medium.
That's what people are saying. Because
I know, I just wonder what that, to whomever, what that means.
You know, the breaking down the fourth wall, the, you know, writing things backwards, the hidden messages, all the shit we can't stand is people are saying that's changing the medium, and I'm like,
that it's just you and I are just jaded, old and jaded.
No, this is the thing. We are intelligent people who like a linear story, a beginning, a middle, and an end. That's the thing.
I don't mind, you know, a juxtaposition of the story, but it's the non-linearness of his work. I don't mind a juxtaposition if it ties together in some way.
Right.
You and I, with Action Comics, his run on Action Comics, my biggest beef about that was DC rebooted, soft reboot or whatever, their universe, New 52,
right.
One of their primary objectives was to bring in new readers, which is complete bullshit because their flagship line, Action Comics, is not for new readers at all.
And
the
again,
first couple issues, written by Grant Morrison, the first couple issues were okay, and then but 5 issues in, it just goes off into this, I don't know where the fuck it goes.
It goes off, and I read the entire thing in the trade paperback, and it still doesn't make any sense, but the way, here's the thing that doesn't make any sense, is it's like issues 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, 5, 6, blah, 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 but it's like issue 5 is where it went off, like, with the, you know,
right.
The superheroes, right. But when they compiled it, they, you know, it's issues 1, 2, 3, 4, 7, and I'm like, if you're not going to reprint it the way it was printed, why are you doing this?
Wait, hold on a second. Do you mean to tell me what you're saying to me right now is that they actually printed it out of order?
They printed it out of order. They,
sequential order, but they printed it in order of the story.
They printed it in order of the story so the readers could follow along.
Oh, see, man. And they, I don't know. That Action Comics with him on it, I don't have a personal problem with him. I mean, if everybody wants to bow down to this guy, then stick him in the corner of the multiverse and let him have at it. But Action Comics, when you're trying to get, when you say you're trying to get new readers on board, that is not an accessible book at all.
No, and, you know, I'm with you, like, the first 4 issues about him, like, you know, first time out and stuff, I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. And then it just...
It got weird, and then all of a sudden he's rushing it. Put him in the costume. It's like, can't we just see where this goes instead of rushing it? It's supposed to be in his early days. I would have been fine with him, like, a couple more, you know, like, 2 years in with the t-shirt, I would have been fine.
You gotta wonder if it was him who wants to get him in the suit, or it's DC that wants to get him in the suit right away.
I don't think they challenged Morrison. Honestly, I don't think they do. I think they just say, all right, you know, Grant, we think whatever, you know, as after they get off their knees and wipe off their chin, they're like, Grant, you know, we think you do whatever you do is great, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, man, I don't know.
It's horrible. And, you know, I find this stuff very unreadable.
Yeah.
And yet,
it's too wacky.
Yeah, and everybody just is...
They love him.
They love him. They really do.
You know, I wonder if they truly love him, or as I've said before, it's cool to love him.
I think that's the case. It's just people. So there's some. Let's face it, just it's not the first time we've seen everybody act like sheep when it comes to comics.
Yeah,
they do that a lot. People don't think for themselves.
I don't know.
They go along with the pack. Somebody tells them this is the best thing.
Yeah,
they're like, okay, let's. This, you're right. This is the best thing. No, try and think about it on your own.
Well, what you and I should do is one of the upcoming issues is a guidebook. It's going to be the 6th book, the Multiversity Guidebook, and it's going to be released in January. I think both of us should pick it up, see what the hell is going on.
And the funny thing is a lot of people are about this PAX America. They thought there was supposed to be, you know, another issue of it. It's only a one shot.
Yeah.
So if people think, you know, if a majority thinks that there's supposed to be more than one issue, you didn't do a good job as a storyteller.
Here's another question I have for you, and you probably don't know the answer, but where is this going? Is this just playing in the sandbox, or does this have some sort of definitive story arc that's going somewhere?
I don't know if it's leading towards convergence or not, which is another thing that's you know, DC just released a bunch of images from, more images from Convergence, which is, you know, even, you know, again, confusing again.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, when we had Fabian on the show, it seemed like, okay, great, you know, they're wrapping up, you know, a couple storylines and stuff.
Right.
And, you know, you and I have kind of talked about how it kind of sounds more like an apology to fans for doing, you know, doing this, you know, but it's...
Tying up loose ends.
Yeah, tying up loose ends, but at the same time, it's really confusing as all hell. What the hell's going on? And it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
I don't know. Because I'm looking at a list of books, and I don't know if this is a complete list, to the list of the books that's falling under multiversity. And I don't see where this wraps up, what the point is with, you know, other short stories, miniseries. There's a arc, and I don't see an arc here. I just see, you know, this guy thinks he's Picasso.
It's, well, like I said before, it's just multiversity. When it was first advertised, was supposed to be, it sounded like an anthology. Where, you know, he goes from, you know, Morrison goes from Earth to Earth to Earth to Earth, you know, telling different stories. I mean, you know, fine, whatever. But then all of a sudden it became this miniseries, and the first, I'm sorry, I only read the first one, and it made no fucking sense.
Yeah.
And I was like, out. I'm out. Yeah. It's crap. It really is. And, you know.
Well, actually, on Wikipedia it says the series is 8 one-shots, with 2 of them being bookends. The bookends will function as a 2-part story, which Morrison describes as an 80-page giant DC super spectacular story. That's on Wikipedia. So, I don't know.
It seems like he did that for the, you know, he's already done that. It was the Seven Soldiers of Victory.
Yeah.
Which was total crap.
Yeah.
It was just like, yeah, let me think. It's just like, okay, we're going to have the first one introduce everybody, and then we're going to have, I think it was like, almost, yeah, it was 7 different characters, all in their each 4-issue miniseries that never really get together. And even at the end of the big, you know, the last bookend thing, they really never got together as a team.
No, you don't say.
Yeah, it was just like, what the fuck?
I wonder if he can even write.
Personally, I don't think so.
I didn't mean it like that. That's awesome. I was going to say, I wonder if you could even write a normal superhero comic book story.
It's,
but that's pretty awesome, Ryan.
If this is a known fact that he is an avid drug user these days.
Is he?
He is.
Well,
I mean, you know, and I think, you know, personally, I think he's dipping in too much, if you want my opinion.
Well, God bless him. How about that Howard the Duck?
Oh, God.
Speaking of trippy.
You're not a fan.
It's not that I'm not a fan. It's that I don't understand. Howard the Duck's before my time.
Right.
And it's a different era. And I know at the end of Guardians there was that, you know, whatever about him. I don't understand the significance of him coming back, I suppose. Or who's, as you have said to me before, you know, what his purpose in the 70s was, it had maybe a social kind of thing.
His entire book was satire about, you know, what was going on in the world. He was the only one who could, you know, it's, Marvel was afraid to really tell stories about the real world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, here comes Howard the Duck, and they could get away with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he became kind of a cult icon. You know, then, you know, he's the first Marvel comic to have a movie for some odd reason. Which I'm still trying to figure that one out.
So, what's the relevance of today?
I think people just like him. It's like anything of memorabilia. They just want him back.
Okay.
Personally, I don't understand why it's bringing him back. You know, it's...
Well, here's a thought. And maybe this has something to do with it. I just said he was at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
Says at the end he's going to go after Star-Lord. There's something he's pissed off about Star-Lord. And so maybe this new book coming back is some sort of lead into Guardians of the Galaxy 2, which really we don't know anything about. And as Jim Gunn has said recently, that he wants to keep it away from the rest of the Marvel Universe. So maybe that's what's going on here.
Maybe.
Back me up here, Brian.
I don't know what's going on.
I don't know. I just don't see clamoring for Howard Duck.
No.
But I didn't see clamoring for Squirrel Girl, so whatever.
You know, it's, you know, I mean, Gunn has said that, you know, Howard could reappear in, you know, in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but he'll never get his own film again.
Yeah. Well, and what was his deal? What is his origin, Howard the Duck?
He was transported from a planet called Duck World.
Oh, was he from the fifth dimension with Mixoplick?
Something like that.
Oh, however you say his name these days.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll see where that goes. And the other Marvel news that we've got going on is casting rumors for Jessica Jones and Luke Cage. Were they separate shows?
Yes.
Like, is there a Jessica Jones show?
Yes, it's all part of this Defenders thing they're doing on Netflix.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's 13 episodes of each.
Oh, cool.
And
I didn't realize she was getting her own show and Luke Cage was getting his own show.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, then they're all going to come together as the Defenders. The next after is also Iron Fist, so they're just going to, it's those four heroes.
I got you. I understand it now. Oh, that's pretty cool. So yeah, there's been some casting rumors about those two. And it's nice to see that they're moving forward with this stuff.
Yeah, I know, thank God.
Yeah. Because I don't think that there's been much word about when Daredevil's supposed to be debuting, right?
No, they're still just saying 2015.
Yeah.
They're not saying exactly when in 2015.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what's going on with that. In a recent Twitter chat, the producer was kind of vague about whether we're going to actually see the real costume or not. Ooh. Which could be, you know, he said it, some part of the inspiration was Man of Fear, which Man Without Fear. He didn't wear his costume. He didn't see it till the last panel.
Yeah.
So it might be something like that, but, you know, like we've talked about, you know, the footage I saw still kicked ass.
Yeah.
I could live without the costume, but the fact he didn't have the Billy Club disturbed me more. I would rather see that than, you know, than the costume. It's just that he needs that club.
Yeah. Well, like you just said, it's only clips that we've seen, so. And I don't think I have too much of a problem with the costume not. I guess we're sort of used to it, because, look, Smallville went all those years without the costume, and that seems to be the thing. We got Gotham going on now, which is the costume. We won't talk about Gotham.
Thank you.
I just brought it up as a, for instance, as an example.
No, but it's all on how they do the costume.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I know a lot of people didn't like Affleck's film, but I didn't think the costume was that bad.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I looked at the costume. I didn't think it was that bad.
It was a pretty good costume.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. I've seen worse. Hey, Brian, I just want to point out, at this show, we did not talk about any TV shows.
Yeah, I don't think we should, because I got beaten up.
Did you? Who beat you up?
My Gotham article.
Oh, really? Damn it.
Yes.
I should have mentioned it. I did mention Gotham, though.
It's always entertaining to see who actually gets something and who doesn't. And, you know, it's, you write something and, you know, people take away what they want to take away. Yeah. And it's, you know how it is, man. It's frustrating. It's just like, you make one point and people just immediately go into nerd rage without even reading it.
So what you're saying is DC fans are as bad as Marvel fans?
Oh, can be just as worse sometimes. Huh.
All right, yeah, so this is Turkey Week. I probably will have something coming out, maybe. We'll see.
If you're not in a food coma.
Yeah. All right, well, everybody have a great Thanksgiving.
Yes.
And you can still check out me on YFNJMan.com, and me and Brian on CastersCorner.com.
Right.
And since we are going on turkey break, feel free to listen to the old episodes of Fanboy Factory Podcast. FanboyFactor.com.
Yes, sir.
And that's a litany of websites.
Yeah. You can find all the links on FanboyFactor.com, and, you know, we're always there.
All right. Brian, have a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you, sir. You too.
Take care.
Night, everyone.